Yesterday afternoon, I gave you the four views of the world, which are characteristic of the Kegon philosophy, and supply a sort of convenient summary of its general outlook. The world seen as simply things and events. That is, from the point of view of multiplicity. That's the first view. And that's called G in Japanese. I'm giving you the Japanese words because they're easier to remember. The second view of the world is things seen from the standpoint of unity. That is to say, just as the mirror provides a unity, a base, that is to say, for all the separate images in it. So you might say that the mind or space, and there is a way in which the two are the same, provides the unity for all the manifold things and events that exist in it. Now, there seems, of course, to be a conflict between these two points of view, the one and the many. And the most ancient philosophical problems revolve around this whole dichotomy. How do you get the one out of the many? How do you get the many out of the one? And it seems that one and many are mutually exclusive. In other words, in practical affairs, we are many. And we all have conflicting interests. What formula are we going to find so that we can agree and act together? See, this is always the most difficult task. And it requires great brains or great insight or great something or other to find the point on which we can all agree and so work together. So there is always an apparent fight going on between the principle of unity and the principle of diversity. Because after all, the diverse people don't want to be too united. You know, if we all had to wear exactly the same clothes and all had to do exactly the same sort of job, there would be a revolution. It'd say, "Brr! Stop interfering with my personality. Individual freedom is important, and it certainly is." And what we've got to do, you see, then, is to find the formula where there is the maximum of individual liberty, but all of it going on together harmoniously. And that's what we, as a political, historical community, have as our theoretical foundation. Isn't that fascinating? You see? We've been trying to work out this impossible problem. And incidentally, the theories of American politics, the basic ideas, are founded on esoteric Christian mysticism. The whole idea of democracy, as we understand it in the modern world, goes back to German mysticism in the 14th century. That is to say, it goes back to people like Meister Eckhart and Tauler, Angelus Silesius, the Brothers of the Free Spirit, the Anabaptists were people who said that all living beings are naturally children of God, and therefore baptism is not necessary to bring a person into salvation. Then there were people called the Levelers, and the Levelers, this movement migrated from Germany through the Dutch countries to England. And during the great Puritan uprisings against Charles I. All these groups began to flourish in England. And the British aristocracy simply couldn't stand them, because they overthrew the whole order of hierarchy by saying everybody is equal. And so they had to get out of England and come here. Now, you will see, of course, there is always the danger of a parody. That is to say, when everybody is equally a manifestation of the Godhead, which is the Quaker doctrine of the inner light, that's what it really comes to. And that's why the Quakers don't recognize any sacraments, because everything is a sacrament. Why the Quakers don't have any ritual, because sitting in together in silence is a ritual. Anything is a ritual. The Quakers want to be make a complete fusion of everyday life and religion, so that you don't notice any religion around. You just have the good life. And so the Quakers won't remove their hats in court. They won't take an oath, because they say, you've got to trust me, because everything I say will be true. So you see, the Quaker idea is the direct continuation of the tradition of Christian mysticism as it flowered in Germany, particularly in the late Middle Ages. The unfortunate parody of all that is that everybody is equally inferior. That's what you always have to watch out for. Everybody can be treated rudely by the police, because you're all equal. And the police aren't going to say, sir, to somebody because he happens to be the mayor or the, well, they may to the mayor, but because you're an important figure in business or something, you're all just Joe, you see. And then that becomes everybody's equally inferior. But if you could imagine where everybody is considered equally superior, this is the foundation of what we call courtesy, good manners, where you salute people and you reverence their right to a certain privacy, a certain separateness, you see. And you have to learn this art in a state of affairs where people start crowding in on each other. Now, you see, in a country like Japan, space is the most expensive thing there is. And it's becoming so here. Space used not to be expensive at all here. There was just oodles of it. And everybody could afford to be equally rude. Now we can't. We're getting crowded in on each other. And to create space, you have to create it by manners. That is, then, respect to everybody. Because, for example, in a Japanese house, there is no privacy such as we understand it. You can hear every belly rumble, because the walls are just paper, and all the rooms are tiny and very close in on each other. And then they, for example, they all take baths together. And they all always see each other naked, but they don't look. To begin with, there's so much steam that you can't really see much. But they have a way of being courteous. Nobody takes liberties in the bathtub, unless somebody wants liberties to be taken. But in the ordinary way, complete strangers will meet together in the public bath of a hotel. And male or female, there are two bathrooms. One says men and the other says women. Men means men and women. And women means women only. But the family bath is always the one labeled men. And everybody goes in there, and nobody is embarrassed, because manners are preserved. The sense of you sort of keep psychological hands off another person, with the notion that they're to be respected. You see, in Japanese culture, everybody bows to everybody else, and they have bowing contests. They outbow each other. When you leave, you know, it goes on interminably. And as it were, you are more polite if you bow more often than the other person. Well, this is all sort of funny from our point of view, but it's still this point. That there is a possibility, in other words, of a cultural form that will stress and get away with the prospect, I mean, not the prospect, the proposition, that everybody is equally divine, as distinct from the proposition that everybody is equally inferior. And that feeling and the manners that go with it is essential in any community where we start to crowd and we get a population explosion. So this is one thing we have to do to solve this huge question of the swarming population, especially in the United States, which is not used to the idea of courtesy. Not really. That we've got to make a propaganda for great respect to everybody. Otherwise, we won't be able to accommodate the crush at all. The funny thing about the Japanese, incidentally, is that they've learned the manners of mutual respect under certain circumstances. But new circumstances arise in which they haven't learned it. And one of these is the subway, which is total pandemonium. They pack everybody into the subway like sardines, and they have special officials whose duty it is to push people in and to see that they're all jammed in. They just shove the crowd. Then when each official at the separate door has got it, he signals and the doors close. Although in this situation, the Japanese, although they are shoving and pushing and so on, when you're absolutely tight up against Japanese man or woman, they're all right. You know, they're not going to pick your pocket or something like that. They endure it. But they fight and struggle and shove to get place. After that, they relax. But they are not used to this situation, and therefore haven't found out the proper manners for dealing with it. So, this is then an example of solving a problem by seeing the one in the many. Namely, that treat every many as the one, that is to say, accord respect, then the many will be able to get along together. And that, in other words, underlies our simplest ideas that every individual has equal rights in the eyes of the law. Only don't invert it, meaning that every individual is equally nobody. This comes about, of course, when we're in a hurry. When you're in a hurry, you can't be bothered to look at the details. And you simply wipe it out. So, like, naturally, when you don't provide for sufficient school teachers, every school teacher is dealing with a mass of children and is in a hurry and can't be bothered with the details. When you don't provide for enough judges, the courts are in a hurry and can't be bothered with the details. So always be sure to keep your eyes open. That is to say, to have lots of teachers and pay them properly, lots of judges and pay them properly so that they won't accept bribes, and invest in those aspects of the community which are vital. We're not doing that. In other words, the salary of a teacher in any school is probably lower than that of the janitor. Which simply says what it says. It shows you what you value. Well, now, these four views of the world ended up, of course, with the fourth one, which was called Jiji Muge, the complete harmony of everything event with every other thing event. And I wanted to show you that this harmony exists anyhow. That however wrong things may appear to go, there is a point of view from which you can see a connection, which is a harmonious, rational connection. Just as if in your everyday life you realize that if you hadn't lost a certain job, you would never have been in the situation where you met someone you love dearly. You see? And you can, in retrospect, you can see all this connectedness going along. And one of the fascinating things in human relations is to figure out the network. You know, there's a saying that there are only 500 people. This is a certain kind of joke. But it has to do with the fact that you have a network of friends who are, you know, the sort of people you think really are people. And they're all interlocked with each other in funny ways. It has been estimated that this should be a little larger figure, about 14,000. That has something, that's a different joke. And it has to do with the fact that communication has become easier than it used to be, with the cheap telephone rates and all that, and the jet aircraft. But there is this wonderful feeling of a network of people who know people, and you get wonderful surprises because you meet someone and you find that they're the dearest friends of your old friend, and so on and so forth. Now, from one point of view, then, there is already existing between every single event and thing that happens a harmony. But this harmony is not manifest in terms of human conduct. It is there, even in the worst human conduct. But it's not manifest. That is to say, we do not have, by any stretch of the imagination, a really civilized society. And the Buddhists would say that you cannot have the really civilized society until you first realize that the harmony already exists. In other words, if you think you have to create the harmony socially by some sort of moral violence and impose it upon the world as it exists now, you will only succeed in stirring up more trouble. That's why reformers tend to be extremely destructive people. People with a fanatical mission. It is necessary first to see that absolutely nothing needs to be done to improve the world, then it can indeed be improved. And this is another way of talking about what Blofeld referred to in his little essay as renunciation, or complete giving up of self. Now, you cannot give up yourself, let go of your own self-interests, and suddenly say, well, from today, I'm no longer going to press my own advantage against everybody else. You can't do that by a voluntary decision, because you will merely be using a new gimmick to boost yourself. Look at me, I'm the most unselfish person. How saintly I am, you see? Only you may not say that to others. That would be a little uncool. You would say it to yourself, though. See, look at me, I'm really going to make this thing. There's no way, therefore, you see, of being unselfish or of renouncing clinging on purpose. It can be done only in the realization, when you actually come down to it, you see, that you cannot cling to anything at all. There is nothing to cling to, and there is no one to cling. And this is the realization of what the Buddhists call voidness. The simplest manifestation of voidness is the fact that everything is in a state of flux. Everything is falling apart. I mean, it's very vivid to me on this ferry boat, because we are literally falling apart. The hull is rusting underneath, there's dry rot in the wood, and it'll last a certain time, and while it lasts, we'll stay. See? But really, it would be a fantastic project to preserve the whole thing, and the money, if such money were available, had better be spent some other way. But there is a sense. When you live in the moving tides and watch all this junk out here growing and rotting and everything, that this is the floating world. And nothing is permanent at all. People create around themselves illusions of permanence by building houses out of concrete and steel and granite and so on. And then when they get inside there, they feel now that is put in order. But actually, it's only a focus of your attention, because the moment you solve and permanentize a problem on one level, say you make a lot of money and you build yourself a very solid house, then you start worrying about your health. Because that's something you really can't control. It's very fluid, very volatile, as it has to do with all your veins and intestines and nerves and all these gooey things that don't stay put. So you worry about that. This is where you focus your attention. But so if you become aware of what's happening really in this world, you see as a basic proposition that everything is completely falling apart. And you think, well, then the obvious thing for a sensible person to do is to make an effort to secure it for as long as possible. And this is what we call the Philistine square practical attitude. This is the bourgeois position, you see. Make the best of the job. Do the work that's nearest, though it's dull at whiles, helping when you meet them, lame dogs over stiles. It's the sort of thing you see on a plate as a souvenir in some place for tourists. hold it together as long as you can. And there's something about that that we all laugh at. I don't know why, but we do. But it's not a very heroic attitude.
not a very interesting attitude. Well, there's something else. That is the synthesis of despair and courage. In other words, that the total courage arises out of seeing that there is really nothing can be done. Holding things together for as long as you can hold them together is a sort of illusion, because you know time's going to run out, and within 100 years nothing will matter. You'll be dead anyway. One reaction to that is, of course, why bother? But the other reaction is, good Lord, if that's the truth, what fun we can have now. You see? If the thing really is an illusion, and it's simply falling to pieces, and in every way there is nothing to grab, you see, in any direction. Now get this now, you see? No, don't say, oh, well, I'll wait till tomorrow to face that. there is absolutely no possibility of anybody in this room being able to stop dissolution. You can start all kinds of new evolutions of dissolution by, say, having children or promoting a society which is going to go on beyond your death and whatever. But if you really get with the thing that there's nothing you can grab, that this is total disintegration. And don't even try to hold on to something like God. Change and decay in all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. Get rid of that, you see? Because that doesn't allow the process to happen that I'm talking about. When you don't hold even on to God, there is nothing, nothing whatsoever. It is just at that moment that you acquire the curious vitality that we call Buddha nature. And that is essential energy, essential courage, and essential compassion. And remember, this can't fully be explained. You can say, but I see no logical connection between the act of renunciation. In other words, I've stopped clinging altogether. Not because I ought to, but because I find out there's nothing else to do. All right, now what's the logical connection between that and the courage and compassion? It's not very easy to point that out, because in order to find out, you have to go through the experience. It's like there's a parallel problem historically about the Calvinists. The Calvinists believed in predestination, that there was absolutely nothing that the individual could do to control whether he would be damned or saved forever and ever, because God had decided in the beginning of all time which individuals he would damn and which he would save. So you would naturally suppose that Calvinists who believed that would be rather dissolute and lazy people, because they would say, well, it doesn't make any difference, there's nothing we can do about it. But on the contrary, Calvinists were not. Calvinists were very earnest people, rather too earnest, one might say. Pillars of conventional probity and prudence and morality and so on. Because they had to prove that they were predestined to be saved. See? So there is a difference between a theory and what you would think would be the application of that theory. The same theory in terms of experience and what will be the consequences of that experience. So here we're discussing, because we're using words, a theory of the total ungraspability of the world,
And that sounds as if it would lead to despair, especially if there is no God to hang on to. Nothing at all to hang on to, you see. Then you would say, oh, well, it's all nothing, you see. But actually, if you get with that nothing, you discover what is fundamentally worthwhile, what it's all about. And that's why they say Buddhists are atheists. Because when you really become one with God, obviously you don't go around worshipping God or asking God for things and making prayers. There's no point in that anymore. Should God pray to himself? So this, then, is a possibility here. When people see that and are living let-go lives, that they could come into harmony with each other in a social sense, political sense. And the question here now in practical politics is this. Is there any way of advocating a certain style of practical politics in everyday life which persuades without preaching? The one thing that is quite evident from the whole history of religion is that preaching doesn't work. I mean, this is the great lesson of religion. When somebody says, you should do so and so, because if you don't, look what awful things are going to happen. Nobody pays any attention. Because they never really make the awful things that are going to happen convincing. It's always hell somewhere when you're dead, or the consequences of not really amounting to being a nice person, you know. What will everybody else think of you? Well, who cares? You can always find a society, a community, where someone will think well of you. So, you know, if you're an outcast in one group, in a civilization like ours, you simply join another. Because we are so diversified. And we make friends very quickly. And nobody knows who you are, what your background is, but they just take you in. You know? In the old world, that's rather difficult. But we have to find a way, in other words, of dealing with our great conflicts based on a kind of cold logic of seeing, of thinking a whole process through. Like, let's take the Chinese. The Chinese are being stupid because they've got the wrong propaganda line. They are squeaking. They're calling out foul. They're saying, you wretched Western barbarians have exploited us long enough. Your capitalists, your imperialists, your this, that, and the other have had it. And we are going to overthrow you, and we are going to overthrow our own landlords, and so on, and they're taking this line. Now, that line is not going to work. It's just going to stir up hostility. In exactly the same way, in our own backyard here, the Negroes are taking the wrong line. Black nationalism means we are just the kind of people the whites always said we were. aggressive, uncooperative, alienated. And if they take that line, let's look at this, you see, as a matter of simply practical politics. If they take that line of black nationalism, they are going to be wiped out mercilessly, because who has the napalm? It's as bad as that. And looking at it from the other side, our white notion that Negroes are somehow inferior people doesn't pay off, because it just creates exactly that trouble. It creates that sort of saw in the body politic. It doesn't make any sense. Well, you could then say it likewise to the Chinese. Look, what you ought to do is, instead of saying, "We're the poor Chinese," you say, get up, stand on your feet and say, "It so happens that we are the most ancient existing civilization on earth, and we have cultivated reasonableness for centuries. And you think Sweden is a reasonable country with a wonderful social democracy. You just wait and see what we're going to do. We are going to be the most reasonable people you ever saw. And everybody will be astonished and will want to go to China, and they'll walk over the whole of Asia. And the reason about all this that I'm trying to say, I always try to emphasize the position that any doctrine of this kind is not preaching. It is not moralistic. It is simply pointing out the nature of the facts. That not that you ought to be unselfish, and you ought not to cling to possessions, to identity, to role, to status. The point is, you can't. And as you realize you can't, you don't. Well, so with other matters of practical politics. When you realize what can't be done, you won't do it. Or try to do it. It's only so long as you're under illusions and think that certain things can be done which can't be done, that then these conflicts arise. And so it is, it seems to me, along these lines, which I will call the lines of cosmologic, that there is perhaps some sort of possibility of bringing about a practical realization of what the Buddhists call the Dharma Dhatu, or the state of affairs in which all individual things and events are in a harmonious relationship. Now, let me, though, underline this point, which is absolutely essential to grasp. That realization in social and ethical terms cannot possibly happen unless those involved in the project have understood that there is no necessity for it to happen. That, in other words, there is a point of view from which it has happened already. Because so long as it must happen, it won't. In other words, when you say, "Oh, gee, we've got to get this done, this is urgent. Come on now, everybody, get in and pitch and so on, and we've got to make this happen," it won't. Bet your life it won't. Because people acting under the sense of necessity and constraint are not free. So this is why the Buddhist lays so much emphasis on the importance of what you might call the let-go personality. The person who doesn't care, doesn't give a damn, to use our own sort of colloquialisms. If I live, okay. If I don't,
So what? It doesn't matter. And that which looks from our standpoint, that sounds so negative, what they've discovered is that is the brightest, most positive, glowing, gorgeous point of view. Now, in the kind of culture and cosmology and view of the world out of which this philosophy arose historically, the general prevailing view is that within a few thousand years the world's going to blow up. You know, Hindu cosmology works on the presupposition that in the course of time everything gets worse. And that only after it has got so bad that it dissolves is time renewed. And when the cycle starts again, everything is as good as possible. It's brand new, you know. It's like a new house, a new car, a new baby. And everything's great. And then as it gets older, it deteriorates and finally falls apart. So there is, you see, about Asian politics, a certain fundamental pessimism in that respect. That in the course of time, everything is going to get worse, and there will come the destruction. Now, then what is the logic, what is the possible sense in talking about this Kegon philosophy, where they really seriously think that there might be the possibility of creating the harmonious world? The answer is this, that to get it, you've got to get into a different kind of time. In the kind of time we are now living in, everything is going to get worse. That's the nature of the time structure. But you don't have to live in this kind of time. You can live in another time structure altogether. You realize this? You can. You can get out of this time, but only when you're disillusioned with it, when you see that it's not going anywhere. For example, you're all educated to believe that the future holds something for you. And you have a graded system of education where you go up step by step by step, always with a come on, saying, now, when you get this thing, it's going to be great. And then when you get there and you're director of the company, chairman of the department, senior surgeon in the hospital, or whatever it is, or you've married the guy, you suddenly realize that you don't have a future because you've arrived. But then an insurance salesman comes around and he tells you that if you buy this retirement policy, there's going to be a great thing ahead of you called retirement. And when you get that, then you've really got there, you know. But then what they're going to do then is put you in a morgue as a senior citizen because you've got prostate trouble, bad teeth, a lousy digestion, your hair's falling out, and you haven't got the energy left to enjoy yourself as you thought you would have. Because if you don't resist growing old and you understand how to grow old, this is no problem. But the point is the constant illusion of that time will achieve what you are really after
is everybody brought up in this way is therefore living in false time. Now, get out of that kind of time, you see, by seeing that it doesn't lead anywhere. Now, I'm saying in another way the same thing as I was saying a moment ago, that you can't stop things changing, so there's nothing to hang on to. And there's no one to hang on to it either. It's like an illusory hand trying to hold firmly to a parcel of smoke. So in these two ways, seeing, in other words, that we're living in a false time, and in this kind of time, everything is going to get worse. So forget it. It isn't profitable time. And you will be able to see that you can look at what you now call the everyday world, see? This actual existence here. You can look at it in an entirely different perspective and live in a different kind of time. This other kind of time is vertical to ordinary clock time. It is a switch of emphasis, in other words, where the eternal now becomes what is supremely important. As we have time at the moment, you see, there is no now. There's the past and there's the future. And there's a hairline at which one becomes the other. And on our watches, you see, I have a little funny watch where the hairlines are so fine that I have to put on my glasses to see them at all. And even then, they've really got them down to the most analytical little tiny lines. But you see what that means? This is a symbol of having no present, because the present has been abolished and made into the abstract hairline, the split second. So there is no present in our kind of time. We are therefore presentless people. We have a past, we have a future, but that's all. No present. So then, that's why Aldous Huxley wrote a book called Time Must Have a Stop. You have to get rid of that time where the present is totally unimportant. What did you do is important. What will you do? That's terribly important. But where are you? Who are you? What are you now? Wowee. It's not there. So then, it is only as people renounce the future and the past that they get a present. Now, the future hasn't come. It's not here, and the past is altogether gone. You can't get that. When you have no future and you have no past, there is nothing else for you to have but a present. And with this fundamental adjustment of human consciousness, you see the everyday world in an entirely different state. You are living in a new kind of time. And you see other people living in their kind of time, which is, of course, going along this way. And you're sorry for them, because they are in an illusion. But it's a free country, and you can dig that illusion if you want to.